All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio231, our second meeting. It's Thursday, January 14th. And so we're going to get started with lecture. But first, we got to talk about how students can find their way into class. There's still a lot of students that want to add the class, and maybe they're here right now. The best way to get into this class is to find an open spot that's in a lab someplace. That's the rate limiting step. So it looks like there's a couple open seats right here, but it's even more crowded in lab. So you have to look in the schedule and go to that lab as soon as it opens up. Okay, talk to the lab instructor and introduce yourself and just politely ask and see if they will give any ad codes out. And that's usually only the case if there's a no-show. Okay.
I just wanted to ask you something else.
Oh, you did. Okay.
Could I quickly remind the students about our information meeting tomorrow regarding volunteer programs in Australia and Costa Rica this summer?
No.
No?
Yep, thanks. Maybe some other time, but I got so much business to take care of. Okay. Sorry about that. Okay. Okay, so don't forget about your supplemental instruction. Okay, where's our supplemental instructor? Raise your hand, right there. Okay, and do we know when we're going to meet yet for the first time? When are we going to meet?
We did this morning.
This morning? Oh, you did this morning already. Excellent. Okay, so if somebody is wondering what that's all about, make sure that you introduce yourself to our SI instructor right here, and maybe we can put some information on the board what the times are. I'll get that into Blackboard as well. Okay, so you should be able just to click and go there. Yes.
Is there
going to
be any other time?
You would have to talk with the SI instructor about that, the SI leader about that, okay? I'm not really so sure.
Okay.
There might be other classes too. Yes, way in the back.
Can we talk to SI instructors as part of the
ACR? Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, even if you make your, as you make your study plan out, consider that as part of your study time, too, because you're thinking about the class and how to get organized and all that kind of stuff, right? Okay. So I think that's really the only opening comments I need to make. But here is the sign-in sheet. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. There are a couple people that added that I didn't put on this list. I didn't have time to put you on the list. So don't freak out if you registered yesterday and you're not on the list, but I did drop all the no-shows. So if you have a name on here and it says dropped, you got to talk to me. That's potentially really bad. Okay. Oh, what I have on the board right here, this is on the screen. A number of people said, oh, I went and I listened to some lectures, and they found that maybe very helpful. And I said, ah, that's great, but they're from the previous semester. It's the same material. I haven't uploaded the lecture that I took on Monday, but I usually get time to do that on Friday or over the weekend or something. So usually I do it from the previous week. And then I had a number of other students say, well, where are those lectures at? I want to go listen to them. And I went to Blackboard, and I didn't see any place on Blackboard. And you know what? It's not on Blackboard. It's on my website that's on the Cypress College server. So it's not in Blackboard. So this is the URL. SEM stands for Science Engineering Math, Cypress College. And then if an instructor in Science Engineering Math has any space on the server, you have to type the little tilde, their first initial, and then their last name, and it will take you there. So you might have all kinds of websites you could look at, personal websites from instructors on campus. So to find the audio tapes, where do we want to go? We want to go to something that looks something like 231, okay? So click on 231. That's your textbook. And here over here, under links, I have lectures. Now, as you can see, I don't have much in the way of material here. Most of your material is on Blackboard. All right, so here is a list of all the lectures. And if you see little music notes like that, that means that it is the WAV file. And it's it probably shows you down on the bottom. If you look at the bottom of your browser down over here, when you put the cursor over that link, it tells you what the file is. That's the WAV file. And then here is the companion text file for that. So if your computer doesn't play or if you have a hearing deficit, you can actually read the lecture. Okay, so it's on that website. And so that's how you mouse around to it. Any questions on that? If you have a question, maybe see me after class or something. Yeah, here's one. It's a verbatim transcript. It's a transcript. The Word file?
No.
Yeah. So I give my lecture to somebody and they type every word I say, every sentence I say, even if it's not a complete sentence. That's how it comes out.
Cool.
And actually, it's much more fun to listen to the lecture. When I listen to the lecture, it makes perfect sense. But when I read the transcript, it just sounds really weird. I don't know why that is. Different modalities just present information in different ways. Because when you read something, you don't hear what the pronunciation and the emphasis of different syllables, you know, it all looks funny. Okay. All right, so that's how you find that. Okay. All right, so let's finish up chapter 1 right here. We're talking about different body regions, body parts, and there's a couple little tricky places. All right, you know what the head is, the neck, and the trunk, and then your appendages are your arms and legs. There's a couple little tricky parts on the appendages. So, for instance, if I were to point to this part of my body right here, okay, what would you think that is that I'm pointing to? Ah, you guys are good. I tried to trick you already. Yes, some people might say, well, that's your leg. But you know what? That's not your leg. This is actually what we call your thigh. So a thigh is between your hip and your knee, and then between your knee and your ankle, right here, this is your leg, right? So your thigh is not your leg. Your upper appendage sort of has the same kind of situation. For instance, if I were to point here, you might want to say, well, that's your arm. But you know what? It's not your arm. It is your forearm, right? So your arm is between your shoulder and your elbow, and your forearm is between your elbow and your wrist. All right, so those are some things. I'm not so sure that that the book talks about that in this chapter, but it's something you should know. All right, so head, neck, trunk, that's all easy. The trunk contains the thorax, the abdomen, and the pelvis. And then your limbs have your arm, forearm, thigh, and leg. But don't forget about your hands and feet, too. We'll get to those sooner or later. Okay, so what's next to talk about? Body cavities. There are a number of body cavities, and body cavities are important because there are things inside these body cavities. They're vital organs, and in order for you to have a vital organ, there's got to be a cavity inside your body to put it. And so let's look at a diagram that talks about the various body cavities, and as a matter of fact, we can have cavities inside of cavities. And some cavities might have 3 or 4 cavities inside it. So we have to know the structure of all these different cavities because they contain important vital organs. All right, so here we can see a profile of a person and we can see some vital organs like the heart. There's got to be a cavity that the heart fits in. Here's the brain. There's got to be a cavity to hold the brain. Here's the spinal cord. And there's got to be a cavity that holds the spinal cord. And you can see the vertebrae that are surrounding the spinal cord, protecting the spinal cord. And what can you guess might surround this brain right here? The skull, some very hard bones. And thank God I have a really hard skull, okay? Because that brain is pretty soft tissue. All right, and then in the abdominal cavity, we have abdominal organs. And in the pelvic cavity, we have pelvic organs. All right, so what do we call the front part of somebody's body? That is anterior. What's another name?
Ventral.
Ventral, anterior and ventral. What's the back part of somebody's body?
Dorsal
or posterior. Yeah, you got to use those terms interchangeably. So you know what? There are cavities that are anterior. We call that the anterior cavity. There are cavities that are posterior. We call that the posterior cavity. So that's pretty easy to remember. They don't communicate with each other. They're separate cavities. All right, so let's take a look at where these cavities are. Nicely color-coded. So here is the dorsal cavity, and here is the ventral cavity. And I didn't tell you guys this. This is going to be fun during the semester before you signed up for this class. All right, I'm colorblind. So there are a lot of times in class I'm going to have to ask you, oh, well, what color is that up there? Because I would like to describe it to you, but I really have no idea what color it is. Okay. And, oh, that reminds me of something else, too. When it comes time for taking the test, guess what the test is going to be? Is it going to be black and white or color?
Black and white.
Black and white. So when you learn structures from the book, don't memorize the color. You have to know the relationship of structures to other structures and by position, not by color, because color is just made up stuff anyway, right, on these diagrams. So don't rely too much on color, and I can help you with that because I can't see these colors at all. But this looks like gold or green or yellow. Or it could be any of those right there. So this is the dorsal cavity, and the dorsal cavity we can break down into two other cavities, namely the cranial cavity here, which holds the brain, and then the spinal cavity or vertebral cavity, which holds the spinal cord. All right, so you should have a feeling of what some organs are contained in these cavities. And I think in lab you maybe did a survey on some large organs inside these various cavities. All right, so again, don't forget, a cavity like the dorsal cavity can be broken down into even smaller cavities, depending on what organs we find in them. All right, the ventral cavity is composed of the thoracic cavity. So that goes from your shoulders all the way down to a very important muscle for breathing, which is what we call the diaphragm. All right, so thoracic cavity contains, what could you imagine is in this cavity? I showed you on the previous slide. Your heart's in there. Your lung's in there. There's a thymus gland in there. There's huge, great vessels that carry blood coming off the heart that are in the thoracic cavity. Okay. And then below the diaphragm is this cavity right here. All right. This one, going down to about where your hip bone is, this is the abdominal cavity. And it contains things like stomach, spleen, pancreas. And then inferior to the abdominal cavity, there is an imaginary line that is separating itself out from the abdominal cavity. We call this the pelvic cavity. And that contains pelvic organs like ovaries, urinary bladder, maybe seminal vesicles, other kinds of things that we're going to look at. All right, so there's no nice anatomical structure that separates the abdominal cavity from the pelvic cavity, like, for instance, between the thoracic cavity and the abdominal cavity right here. Yeah?
Okay, so my question is,
the oral cavity. That's just kind of a cavity that's all by itself. It's really not part of the dorsal or ventral cavity. Okay? There are other kinds of cavities in our body, like there are cavities that help form joints. We would call that a synovial cavity, oral cavity, nasal cavity, but they're just small cavities. Other really small cavities we might call a sinus that you have inside of a bone. So these are all things that you'll pick up this semester. Yeah. So oral cavity, I wouldn't say should be included in dorsal or ventral. It's just kind of a standalone. Yeah. You know, when we get to the skeletal system, you'll know your landmarks, and I can give you some landmarks on the pelvic bones, and once you know those landmarks, then you'll be able to, in your mind, draw where that line is. Okay, but it's a little bit too much to ask for the first week. Okay, but you should know it's down there. All right? And since there is no structure that separates the abdominal cavity from the pelvic cavity, sometimes we consider the abdominal cavity and the pelvic cavity one cavity, because it really is one cavity, right? There's really nothing that's separating one from the other. And we would call that, as a matter of fact, that we can use this to discuss terminology. We're going to learn a lot of terminology and rules in anatomy, and the nice thing about that is once you know that rule, you can apply it to thousands of things. Thousands of names. So that means that you don't have to memorize all these thousands of names. If you know that one rule, just by looking at something, you know so much more than what you can even imagine. So a lot of times in anatomy, we can make up names of things, right? We can combine names. Like, for instance, we have... Is this dark enough for you to see? This is what? The abdominal cavity, right? And we also have pelvic cavity, but we said that the abdominal cavity and pelvic cavity really are one cavity, and if we want to talk about them for some clinical reason as being one cavity, We can combine these words, and all we have to do is put an O between them, like abdominopelvic cavity. That's going to include everything in those two. And that's a legal word, right? You wouldn't get any paper bounce back from a publisher or a critiquer because you're misspelling something. So we can combine words, anatomical words, as long as we do what between them? Put an O between them. Abdominopelvic cavity. Okay. The other thing is that we don't really see on this slide, sometimes the abdominopelvic cavity we might want to call the peritoneal cavity. Peritoneal. So when you hear peritoneal, that really means what? Abdominopelvic. And of course, when you say abdominopelvic, you got to pronounce it nice and clearly so somebody doesn't think you're saying abdominal, because it's not, right? Abdominopelvic cavity. Okay. So ventral, on this slide right here, the ventral cavity has how many cavities? It has three. But you know what? There's even more. So let's take a look. Okay, inside some of these other cavities. Here is a frontal view of these cavities. And let's turn our attention to the thoracic cavity. And it's probably still nicely color-coded. Here is the thoracic cavity. And we can see that inside the thoracic cavities, there's even other cavities. The lungs are in their own cavity within the thoracic cavity. All right, so here's the right one, here's the left one. We call these the pleural cavities. All right, so when you hear that term pleural, you should think of lungs. And an inflammation of the lungs, or the lining of the lungs, sometimes we call that pleurisy, right? Because that's an inflammation of the pleural cavities. And then there's a cavity between the right and left pleural cavities. We call this the mediastinum. So right here is the mediastinum. That's another small cavity inside the thoracic cavity. That's really important to know. A lot of people maybe take anatomy classes and don't become familiar with that term, but it's very important. Because what do we have inside that mediastinum right there? The heart is there. So the heart is located right here. But the mediastinum is also up over here. The thymus gland is there, as well as major blood vessels that take blood away from the heart. So when somebody has a congenital malformation of their heart and blood vessels, right, like when you're first born, then a lot of doctors are going to order a mediastinal scan of that area, or an MRI of the mediastinum. So we use that term all the time. It's very important, okay? Yeah. Thymus gland. It's in this region right here. That's an important part of your immune system. It helps fight infection, okay? The thymus gland makes a certain kind of immune cell called a T lymphocyte. T because it's a thymus gland. And I don't want to talk about the function of those, but maybe you've heard of a T lymphocyte. All right? Because T lymphocytes work in the thymus gland. They grow up and mature in the thymus gland. That's one of the jobs of the thymus gland. Okay, so mediastinum. And furthermore, the mediastinum can be broken down into the superior part right here, and the inferior part of the mediastinum holds only the heart, so we call that the pericardial cavity. Pericardial cavity. Is the label close to that on there? Oh, good. Okay. And an inflammation of the pericardial cavity is called pericarditis. And can you think that might be a dangerous disease to have? When you have an inflammation of your heart? Oh, yeah, really bad. Okay, pericarditis. So you got pleurisy, inflammation of the pleural cavity, pericarditis, inflammation of the pericardial cavity. And this, we said, is the abdominal pelvic cavity, otherwise known as the peritoneal cavity. If somebody has an inflammation of the peritoneal cavity, we call that peritonitis. When might somebody get peritonitis? Could you think of a circumstance when somebody would get a peritonitis? Maybe. Ascites, when fluid builds up. Maybe not strictly an infection, that is just an edema, but ascites when fluid builds up. But something that's pretty common is when somebody has an inflamed appendix, and maybe it will burst. That's what's going to cause an acute peritonitis. So that's how you would use that terminology. And you can live through something like that, though you probably don't feel like you really want to at the time. It's not necessarily fatal, but it's very serious, right? It's best to get that inflamed appendix out of there before it bursts open. Anybody live through a burst appendix in here? No? That's good. That's good. Okay. All right, so those are the cavities. Let's see what else we have to talk about a little bit. Okay, let's talk about membranes just a little bit. A membrane is something that covers a surface or lines a cavity. A membrane covers a surface or lines a cavity. And since we're talking about cavities, we're going to talk about membranes that line a cavity. Somebody mentioned the oral cavity already. All right, that I really didn't talk about that, but I'm glad you mentioned it. Your oral cavity is a cavity. Yeah. Oh, you don't have that in your notes? This slide right here? Uh-oh. Got to copy it down. Huh?
There's more
things we're missing. Uh-oh. Okay, well, copy these down. Maybe I can put this on the web for you. Okay. Okay. Maybe they rearranged the book or something on me. Okay, so a membrane is something that lines a cavity or covers a surface. And somebody mentioned the oral cavity. That's a hole inside your body. But is your oral cavity closed or is it open to the outside world? It's open to the outside world. What about your nasal cavity? Same thing, open to the outside world. Now what about that pericardial cavity that's holding the heart? Is that open to the outside world? It's not. Nothing from the outside world can get around the heart without going through your body first. Okay, so that's a closed cavity. What about your lungs? On the outside of your lungs, is that open to the outside world? It's a little tricky to think of this one. Or is it closed? The inside of your lungs is open to the outside world, but the outside is not. The pleural cavity is closed. What about your abdominal cavity? That's an easier one to think of. Abdominal cavity, is that open to the outside world or not? You know what? It's not. You have a tube running through it, but on the outside of that tube, it's not open to the outside world. So we have two kinds of membranes to consider. We have mucous membranes, and we have serous membranes. All right, mucous membranes are membranes that line cavities that are open to the outside world. And serous membranes are membranes that line cavities that are not open to the outside world. All right, so that's a big distinction between these two kinds of membranes. And a mucous membrane may or may not actually secrete mucus. That's not really a good definition. Most do, some to some degree more than others. Okay, but what is mucus? Anybody know what mucus is? It's a slippery substance, and actually it helps fight infections because it prevents the growth of bacteria. There might be enzymes that break bacteria down, and it prevents inflammation because it's slippery, okay, and it also protects the surfaces that mucus is secreted onto. And it's a lubricant because it's slippery, okay, but it's good because it prevents infections, okay, lubrication prevents inflammation, all right, but a serous membrane, okay, may or may not secrete mucus as well. And it's open, it only lines a cavity that's not open to the outside world. So what were some of the cavities that we learned that don't open to the outside world? Namely the pericardial cavity, the pleural, where do you find the pleural cavity? around the lungs, on the outside of the lungs, and the peritoneal cavity, or peritoneum. That's the abdominopelvic cavity. That's right. Okay. Furthermore, whenever you have a serous membrane, you've got three parts to it. You've got three parts to a serous membrane. A mucous membrane has only got one part. These are the easiest to know. Mucus has one part. Serous membrane is going to have three parts to it. And the three parts, from superficial to deep, what does that mean? What's superficial mean? On the surface. On the surface, and deep means toward the interior. So as you go from outside your body into that organ, you touch the superficial surface first, and then eventually you touch the deep surface of it, right? Okay. So the deep surface is what we call the visceral part of the serous membrane. The middle part is what we call a serous cavity, and the superficial part is what we call the parietal part. So the one that's on the surface is the parietal division of the serous membrane. The deep part is the visceral division. All right, so let's see that. And then there's a little space in between them, which we call a cavity. All right, and that's not a dorsal cavity or a ventral cavity. This is just a little special cavity all by itself. And it's filled with a fluid, serous fluid. Okay, so let's look and see how we can conceive of something like this. Okay, so here we have a balloon. And here we have somebody sticking their hand inside the balloon. So can you see that right on the surface of this hand right here, there is part of the balloon. The balloon is just stretching right over the hand as you put your hand inside a balloon. And I guess there wasn't a whole lot of air inside the balloon to begin with, otherwise it would have popped, right? But somebody hardly blew up a balloon, put your hand inside there. So part of the surface of the balloon is right along the hand right here. And as you go, move up to the wrist, right, what now do you see? You see that the balloon, okay, forms also the outer surface right here. So these are the two parts of a typical kind of serous membrane. The superficial part is on the outside, and we call that the parietal division of a serous membrane. And, right, it's continuous with the visceral part of that serous membrane. It's just that we have to talk about it in two different ways, because one part of the balloon is touching the hand, that's the visceral membrane, and then here is one that is on the outside part of that cavity, or the superficial part of the cavity, that would be the parietal division. And what do you have between these two? You have a space. That's what we call the serous cavity. And there's going to be a fluid in there that we call serous fluid. So instead of a hand, you could actually think, well, that this hand is really a heart inside somebody's body. And the heart has a membrane that's right on the surface. We would call that the visceral pericardium. And then the part that is lining the mediastinum, that's going to be the parietal pericardium. And the fluid between the parietal pericardium and the visceral pericardium is what we call pericardial fluid. And that's the part that gets inflamed and fills up with blood when somebody has pericarditis. So if this part right here is filling up with fluid, hopefully not pus or something like that, but just fluid because it's inflamed, you can see that the heart is being compressed as it fills up with fluid. And as the heart becomes compressed, it still can beat maybe, but if it's compressed, guess what? Blood can't flow into it, because it's being compressed by that inflammation. And if blood can't flow into the heart, even when it contracts, it's not going to pump any blood out. So if you have a heart that's pumping, but it's not pumping blood, that really doesn't do you any good. It's really a serious condition. Yeah. It has different consistencies, but usually it's not as slippery as mucus. It has a tendency to be a little bit more like water. Okay, when we get to, I would say maybe in the peritoneum, it's a little bit more slippery. There might be some mucus associated with it, but in the pleural cavity, it's more watery. The consistency might change depending on the cavity a little bit. Okay, but it should never contain white blood cells or red blood cells, because that would be a sign of inflammation, infection. Okay. So let's look at those three serous membranes. And here we have the heart. I want to zoom in, I think. I'm going to lose my pointer when I zoom in. How's that? Oh, that's really good. All right, so here, what cavity is this organ in? Pericardial cavity. Pericardial cavity is inside which cavity? Mediastinum. And the mediastinum is inside the thoracic cavity, and the thoracic cavity is inside the ventral cavity. Yeah, okay, so you should be able to think of all those different things right there. All right, so this cavity right here is not open to the outside world, so what kind of membrane is it? Mucus is serous. It's got to be a serous membrane. How many parts are there to a serous membrane? There's three. All right, so the most superficial part we see right here, this is the parietal pericardium because it's surrounding the heart. It is continuous when it moves up to the superior part of the heart, and it folds over and then starts to form right on the surface of the heart. Okay, so this is the visceral pericardium. And then you see that space that's between them. That's the serous pericardium, or the serous cavity filled with serous fluid. Okay, so do I need to, here I can see this. Right, this right here looks like, I don't know, some kind of color, and it looks like it's the same color as that right there.
Yeah.
Because they're continuous, but they're in two different locations, so we have two different names for them. Okay? Where do I have the cursor right now? What part is that?
The visceral pericardium.
And we say visceral because when we talk about organs that are deep inside a body cavity, we say that they are part of your viscera. It's a visceral organ. So since they're on part of your viscera, that's the visceral serous membrane. Somebody had a question. Yeah. The serous fluid? It absorbs shock, and it decreases inflammation. Because what is this heart doing inside your mediastinum all the time? Oh, it's beating. And you know what? It's beating in there pretty violently. Some people that are really thin, you can actually see their heart beating right through their chest wall. Okay? And so you need that cavity to absorb shock and to prevent inflammation. Okay? All right, so let's see. Last time I talked about an organ system that had a really strange name. And I said it was going to be on the test probably because, well, if you got to just learn all these things so that you sound educated. In here. What was that organ system? Integumentary system. That means skin. Okay. Which body cavity is really strange that probably you had never heard of unless you took an anatomy class? You probably heard of abdominal cavity before and thoracic cavity. I probably won't test you on something quite so simple as that. But what is one that's really more difficult to imagine because you haven't heard of it before? Mediastinum. That's probably one I'm going to pick on. Okay, and the mediastinum separates what two cavities?
The
heart. The heart is inside the mediastinum. Okay.
Separates the two lung ones.
Yeah, what do we call the lung ones?
The pleural
cavities, that's right. The mediastinum separates the right from the left pleural cavities. All right, so I like to use this terminology in class so you become a little bit more familiar with it. All right, so that's the pericardium. What else do we have? We have the lung, so here is the pleural serous membrane. So here is the, let's see if I can, maybe I'll blow it up just one more time. All right, so here is the parietal division of the pleural serous pleural membrane. Here is the serous cavity filled with serous fluid. And here is the visceral pleural membrane. All right, so I think you can get this stuff. All right. Oh, you know what else? We're not going to meet on Monday, don't forget. But I want you guys to start working on your study plan. All right? Figure that out. You don't have to turn it in, but if you want to show, I don't give any course points for it, but if you want to show me your study plan, that would be really nice. And let me know how it goes for you, if there's any way possible to get that amount of time. And correlate it with your grades, and also show your lab instructor, and maybe they can have some helpful hints for you. Okay? Okay. All right, so that's the pleural membrane. And then this is the peritoneal serous membrane. Now, what kind of view do we have right here? What kind of plane was used to give us this picture? Transverse. Remember, you got transverse. What was this one? Right smack in the middle. It's sagittal, but since it's right smack in the middle, it's even mid-sagittal. Here's parasagittal, yeah. And then this one is the transverse. So transverse separates what two parts of your body? Superior from inferior. So that's how you should be able to talk about the various planes, right? Anterior from posterior, right from left. Right and left are important and recognized anatomical terms. Okay, up and down aren't, but right and left are. Because people have a clearly defined what? Anterior and posterior. So there's no ambiguity there. So here's a nice transverse plane. We can see a vertebrae. We can see some kidneys. But this right here defines the peritoneal cavity. Right, this is the peritoneal cavity. And here is part of that serous membrane. Which part of the serous membrane do I have the cursor on? That's the parietal peritoneum. Here is the visceral peritoneum because it's right on the surface of the liver right here. And it also is continuous with all the other organs inside the abdominal cavity, like the stomach and spleen and pancreas. All right, so this is the visceral peritoneum. Here's the peritoneal fluid that gets inflamed, of course, when you have a burst appendix. And then this is the parietal division lining the body wall on the inside of the abdominal pelvic cavity. One thing I will want to mention a little bit later on, notice these kidneys. Anybody hear of a kidney before? Important organ, right? Definitely an important organ. And notice that the kidneys are not inside the peritoneal cavity. All right, so what is this? Is this anterior or posterior? That's anterior, and here is posterior back over here. The kidneys are behind the peritoneal cavity. Sometimes we call that retroperitoneal. The kidneys are retroperitoneal, meaning that they're outside of the peritoneum. That's a little bit hard of a concept, I think, but when we get to the renal system, I will use that term, and I don't have this slide in that chapter. But this is a really nice slide to see that the kidneys are about in that same region as your abdominal organs, but they're what? They're actually behind the peritoneum. Okay. Maybe somebody can remind me to put this slide in there at that time. Okay. All right. So you know what? I think we're getting... Here are just some other cavities. I think we're done with this chapter, but we can see the nasal cavity, oral cavity. We're going to talk about many other little kinds of cavities, but nonetheless important in your body. All right, but they're not the major cavities. All right, so that's it for this chapter. Okay. All right, moving on to the next one. Wow, what does that look like? I like doing that a lot. I like showing you something for just a second and then taking it away. Ah, cytology, here we go. Okay, so cytology. What the heck is cytology? That was a kind of anatomy that we talked about last time. It's a study of something. Study of? The cells, right. Study of cells. View. Zoom. Okay, so that's better. Okay, well that seems pretty basic. I know in lab you're looking at some cells, even some of your own cells. So that's pretty cool. You got to stain them really before you can see them very well. And maybe you've noticed that when you look at a cell, it's very transparent. When you stain it, you can even see stuff inside the cell. You can see all kinds of junk inside the cell. Can't quite make it out because it's really small. So today I'm going to show you what that stuff is that you're actually seeing. So if you had a microscope that could enlarge it enough, these are some of the things that you see in there. And if somebody has a sore throat. You might even see some bacteria on that slide. That's why, what do we have you do when you're done with your microscope slide in lab? Okay. Well, there's actually, I think there's a little tray that has bleach in it. And when you're done, put that microscope slide in that bleach and that will kill everything that's on that slide. Okay. I don't think anybody has any really bad diseases in here, but it's always good to learn about how to perform these septic techniques, right? Just for practice. Okay, a cell. So a cell is microscopic. You need a microscope in order to see them. And the cell is the basic unit of life. There's a lot of times in this class I'm going to talk about the structural and functional unit of something. And if you know how this structural and functional unit is put together and how it operates, you know an amazing amount of detail about a whole range of subjects. So we're going to use the cell as a building block to how to make somebody's body. Right? And you have trillions of cells inside your body, but at one time you were just one cell. Right? And we're going to talk about how you get from one cell to trillions of cells. And it's much better to be trillions of cells compared to just one cell. Why is it much better to be trillions of cells instead of just one cell? Because you couldn't take notes if you were just a single cell, right? So it's good to be many, many cells. So the basic living unit of all organisms, right, is the cell. A cell must contain genetic material and cytoplasm, two things. All right, and if it doesn't contain those two things, then it is not a cell. It's easy to see that in human cells. All life is cellular. The simplest organisms, we say, are unicellular. They're just a single cell. If you take a biology class, you probably look at some of these unicellular organisms. Anybody take a biology class and look at some of these? Yeah, what's a name of one of these critters? Anybody remember a name of one of these things? Like an amoeba or a paramecium? Yeah, paramecium. These are just single cell organisms. They can move around in water, but that's pretty much about it. And humans are made up of trillions of these cells. And we're replacing them all the time, too, as a matter of fact. All right, so a cell is very important because all life today on this planet can only come from cells through some kind of reproductive process. Life just doesn't develop by itself anymore. Okay, and the other thing is kind of interesting is a virus. A virus can cause infections in people. A virus has genetic information, has genetic material, right? It has DNA, but it doesn't have any cytoplasm. So I would ask you, is a virus a cell? Is a virus alive?
No,
because it doesn't have cytoplasm, right? So a virus is not alive. So viral infections typically are very difficult to treat in people because if something's not alive, there's really nothing you can do to kill it, right? So like if you have a bacterial infection, we can fight bacterial infections with antibiotics because we can learn how to kill these bacteria, not so with viruses. So they're a little bit more difficult to treat. All right, so let's look at a normal cell. So here is a picture of a nice normal cell. And here is the membrane that surrounds a cell. That's not a serous membrane or a mucous membrane. That's what we call the cell membrane or plasma membrane that separates the outside world from the living world inside of this cell right here. And we see a lot of other kinds of membranes inside the cell as well. So membranes are used to make compartments within inside of a cell. Right, and one of the first things that you should be aware of is this plasma membrane. Plasma membrane is real important because it allows the things that a cell needs from the non-living world to enter, and it allows things that the cell wants to secrete to the outside world, or maybe waste products. So waste products can leave the cell because waste products can become toxic and kill the cell. So the cell membrane is very important for regulating which materials can enter and leave. And at what particular time? Okay. Now, inside this, our kinds of cells have genetic material that is surrounded by another membrane. This is what we call the nucleus. And inside the nucleus is our DNA, our genetic material. That's the blueprint on how to build our body. But not only that, but it contains information to control all the activities that are working inside the cell. So it contains the blueprint, but also information how to control what's happening inside the cell. And one of the functions that this DNA controls is maybe how quickly the cell divides and reproduces itself. So if that genetic material gets damaged, the cell loses that regulation, right? It becomes damaged, and what kind of process does that produce when the cell divides and divides and divides and doesn't listen to regulation? Okay, it's going to form a tumor, right, or cancer, right? So that, so the importance of this genetic material is hugely important. Right. Let's look at some. This is an exam figure, by the way. So you got to be really familiar with this. But don't learn this figure by what?
Color.
By color. That's right. It's only going to be in black and white. And I think in the study guides, hopefully I put the diagrams in black and white. Okay. So if not, use your Microsoft Word and convert it to black and white and just practice labeling in black and white, not color. Okay. All right. So here is a structure that kind of looks like a bean. This is what we call mitochondria. And the mitochondria is real important because it makes energy for the cell. Last time I talked about the energy molecule. Anybody remember what the energy molecule is? ATP. This is the guy that makes ATP for you. Right? The mitochondria makes ATP. It needs oxygen in order to make ATP. So that kind of explains why you can't hold your breath for very long. Why is that? Because when you breathe in, that brings oxygen into your body, and that oxygen then is given to the mitochondria, and the mitochondria say thank you, and they make ATP to keep you alive. All right, so you can't live while you're holding your breath because these mitochondria need oxygen. All right, well, maybe I'll sort of stay with what I have on this sheet right here. Oh, we're talking about the plasma membrane. That's really a good one to start with. So let me continue with that. Let's zoom in to one area of the plasma membrane. This is what the plasma membrane looks like if we were to have a high-power microscope and look at it. And there are some that are able to do this. We call these electron microscopes. We don't have them in lab for you to play with, though. We have light microscopes. So if we were to look just at the plasma membrane, or actually any kind of membrane, we see it looks like this. And what does this look like right here? How would you describe this thing right here? This little, that's a wave to me. That kind of looks like a wave. And as a matter of fact, the plasma membrane is very fluid in nature. So when you see a wave on it, the membranes are kind of very fluid in their basic nature. You can see one molecule, one pattern that repeats itself over and over and over again. Right? And it kind of has this little round part to it with two little legs sticking off of it. Right? And can you see that this molecule forms this one layer on the intracellular side? And what can you tell me about the extracellular side of this membrane? It's very similar. Right? So this molecule right here we call a phospholipid. And they like to arrange themselves in these sheets. And a membrane is just two sheets of these phospholipid layers. So we have a tendency to call that the phospholipid bilayer. These things just build themselves automatically. And this phospholipid bilayer is very fluid. Now, could somebody tell me, if you have a drop of oil and you put it on like a glass of water or something, what's going to happen to that oil when you drop it on the water? Is it going to dissolve in, or is it going to like sink to the bottom, or what?
Yeah.
It's just going to float right on the top. It's going to form a film. And all cell membranes basically are like those films because that oil, or this phospholipid, has many characteristics of that oil. Okay? So, and when you shake that glass, what happens to the film that's right on the surface of the water? Does it fracture and break, or what does it do? It just kind of waves right along right on the surface of the water. So cell membranes do that too. They're very fluid in nature. They're like a film. All right, and inside that film, a cell can dissolve various other kinds of chemicals. As a matter of fact, the phospholipid bilayer is way too fluid. Right? It's actually too fluid. It has to be modified because if it wasn't modified to be a little bit thicker, your body would just run out on the floor. All right, the membranes would be too fluid. So your body sticks some other kinds of compounds in it, namely this one right here. This is cholesterol that gives some rigidity to the cell membrane. All right, cholesterol gives rigidity to the cell membrane. Have you heard of cholesterol before?
Yeah.
Too much is bad. Not enough is bad too, because you can't make cell membranes. You got to have just the right amount. Okay. So here you can see that cholesterol is a lipid, so it can dissolve in the plasma membrane very easily. You can see some bigger molecules dissolved in this phospholipid bilayer. These are proteins, and these proteins sometimes have a channel going through them. And this allows certain molecules to go from inside the cell to the outside, or from the outside of the cell to the inside. It's a passageway. And the cell can control that passageway by putting a gate on it right here. And that gate can open and close depending on when the cell wants to have certain things leave or enter. Right? And I think when you take a physiology class, you'll learn a lot about these kinds of proteins. But you should know that there are these proteins in the membrane that we call channels that allow molecules to move back and forth. Because not everything can move back and forth across this membrane. As a matter of fact, only a few things can. Only things that can dissolve in lipid can move across the membrane. Things that dissolve in water can't. All right, other proteins that are dissolved inside the membrane might have these other molecules attached to them. We would call this a glycoprotein. So a protein is one kind of biological molecule, and glyco means sugar. So here is a molecule that's part protein, part sugar. And these sugar parts of the molecule, you can see, have a certain shape to them. And these are what we call antigens. Antigens are like little name tags that identify the cell as belonging to you. So all the cells on your body have these little branch chains of carbohydrates sticking off of the cell, and all your cells have the exact same design. So all the cells of your body know they belong to you. And your brothers and sisters have designs that are similar but a little bit different. So if we were to take, say, for instance, blood from your brother or sister and give it to you, your body would reject it because of these antigens on the cell surface. And as you move farther and farther away from your family, then the designs of these antigens are even more different. And when you go to different species, you know, like squirrels and worms and things like that, the design is what? Even more different. So your body knows all the cells that belong to you because they have the correct design of these antigens that are sticking off the cell membrane. That's where you find antigens. Okay, other kinds of proteins that might be embedded in the plasma membrane could be enzymes that convert one kind of compound to another. Or they could be listening for signals from other cells. We call those receptors. So this membrane right here is not just a simple phospholipid bilayer, right? That's the simplest description of the plasma membrane, right? So the simplest description of the plasma membrane is phospholipid bilayer. There's two layers that make a membrane. But a better and more sophisticated understanding of the plasma membrane is what we call the fluid mosaic model. The phospholipid bilayer is very fluid. But it is also a mosaic because we have many, many more compounds that can be attached to the membrane or dissolve in the membrane to adjust the properties of that membrane for transport, for recognition, for allowing chemical reactions to take place. Right? Enzymes allow reactions to take place. So the plasma membrane is a very active spot because of that. Oh yeah, don't forget channels for allowing things to move in or out of the cell. Okay. All right, rough endoplasmic reticulum and smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Let's see what that looks like. These are membranes as well that are inside the cell. And here is endoplasmic reticulum. And here is some endoplasmic reticulum. And if you look at this one, it kind of looks like sandpaper. So guess which one that is. Is that smooth or rough? That's the rough one. That's rough endoplasmic reticulum. Here is smooth endoplasmic reticulum because it doesn't have those dots on it. So let me tell you what those dots are. These dots are another organelle, and we call those ribosomes. Ribosomes can exist in two places, with inside a cell, on the endoplasmic reticulum, or you can actually find them inside the cytoplasm, just free ribosomes. And the job of a ribosome is to make proteins, protein synthesis. So for each one of these organelles that I have in your notes, you should know one function, one bullet point function for it. So mitochondria, we said, makes ATP. Ribosome makes protein, right. And endoplasmic reticulum, two kinds. One kind has ribosomes, that's the rough, so guess what the function of rough endoplasmic reticulum is? It can make proteins because why? It has ribosomes on it. All right, and when a ribosome makes a protein, all right, it gets secreted to the inside of the endoplasmic reticulum. It can't float around inside the cytosol. It's trapped inside the endoplasmic reticulum. Now, the smooth endoplasmic reticulum right here, can it make a protein? Nope, doesn't have what? Doesn't have a ribosome. But it is important for synthesizing compounds, and the compounds that it makes are lipids. It makes fats. Can you tell me the name of an important lipid in your body already? Like phospholipid, right? If we look at this slide right here, look at all these hundreds of phospholipids. Smooth endoplasmic reticulum makes the building blocks of the plasma membrane. And maybe even cholesterol, that's a lipid. So smooth endoplasmic reticulum is busy building all these lipids for different parts of these organelles. Okay. All right, so we're a little bit familiar now with some organelles and the plasma membrane. I want to go over some general features of a cell. All right, so a cell is defined as being everything inside the plasma membrane. And inside the plasma membrane, we have cytoplasm. So cytoplasm is all the living stuff inside the cell. Cytoplasm is made up of organelles like the mitochondria plus the fluid part inside the cell. So let's see, does anybody know what that fluid part inside the cell is called? That's called the cytosol. So we have cytoplasm. What's a good way to describe cytoplasm? That's all that living junk inside the cells. Everything that's alive, right? It's all the living stuff inside of a cell. And that is made up of what? Organelles plus, there's a little algebraic formula right here, plus cytosol. So cytosol is the fluid part inside the cells. Organelles are those more structural features inside of a cell. And if we put cytosol and organelles together, we get cytoplasm. Okay. Okay, so all of this is cytoplasm. And when you look underneath your microscope, you can see the nucleus, and you can see some other really tiny things inside the cell. Those would be things like mitochondria and endoplasmic reticulum. Whether it was smooth or rough endoplasmic reticulum, you couldn't see for sure underneath the light microscope. Okay. All right, what else do we have? Golgi apparatus. Sometimes we call it a Golgi body. Whenever you run into a word, okay, even in the middle of a sentence, if it's capitalized like that, that means that that name came from some, if it's named after somebody, that's somebody's name. Signor Golgi was somebody that built microscopes, I don't know, a couple million years ago, and was looking at cells. And he found these little structures inside the cell, and so somebody named them, named those organelles after him. So what does a Golgi apparatus look like? Here's a Golgi apparatus, or Golgi body. We use those terms interchangeably, so be familiar with both those terms. Notice that the rough endoplasmic reticulum curls around the nucleus. It's formed around the nucleus, right? But what about this Golgi body right here? It is curving the other way, right? Can you see how it's curved the other way? That means it has a little bit different function. The Golgi apparatus, the two words that best describe what the Golgi apparatus does is that it is important for modification and packaging. It modifies and packages something. It modifies what the rough endoplasmic reticulum makes. What does a rough ER make again?
Proteins.
So the Golgi apparatus gets proteins from the rough ER and modifies it. Maybe it cuts it in half. Maybe it adds a sugar molecule to it. It makes it a glycoprotein. It might add a lipid to it, making it a protein lipid kind of molecule. But somehow it modifies that protein to give its function to that protein. And then it packages the protein into a vesicle. And here we see a vesicle, and it's filled with something. These are the modified products that started in the rough endoplasmic reticulum, moved into the Golgi apparatus, and the Golgi apparatus then pinches off and forms a vesicle, and that vesicle might stay inside the cell, or it might actually move over to the plasma membrane, fuse with the plasma membrane, and then spit out the contents of that vesicle into the extracellular space over here. We would call that secretion. So this Golgi apparatus is important for modifying proteins from the rough ER, packages them into vesicles, which then can be used to secrete that product outside the cell. And one of the products actually we've talked about already is mucus. Mucus is part protein and part sugar. Sometimes we call it a mucopolysaccharide, and you know it has those, what, really slippery qualities. And maybe we'll see it has some other important qualities too. So that's how mucus would be secreted from a cell. So that we call that the secretory pathway, starting with rough ER, moving into the Golgi apparatus, moving into a secretory vesicle, and then being spit out of the cell. That process of releasing material from inside the cell to the outside via this vesicle is what we call exocytosis. So exo means leaving, cytosis just means some kind of cellular process. Okay. So the fate of materials that are produced by the rough endoplasmic reticulum sometimes end up outside the cell, or maybe they stay inside the cell but always inside a vesicle. What is ever made in the rough endoplasmic reticulum never floats around all by itself free in the cytosol. It's always going to be membrane bound. It's going to be inside a membrane system of some kind. Yeah. Golgi body, the Golgi body. There's a monorail system inside the cell. Have you ever been to Disneyland and see that little train that's moving around? And the little monorail system is made up of microfilaments and microtubules. Like, can you see this little structure right here, that little line? All right, that's made from microtubules, and these vesicles can attach to a microtubule, and the microtubule then will carry it around inside the cell, or maybe to the edge of the cell for exocytosis. So microtubules do a couple things. They can give shape to the cell, but they can also pull on the plasma membrane. They can get the cell to change shape, but they're also important for moving things around inside the cell. And you go, wow, that's really complicated. And you know it is pretty complicated. And what is the organelle that controls all of that? It's the nucleus right here that controls all that. Okay, so yeah, those little monorails are real important. Made up of, and microtubules are made out of proteins. Yeah. When the nucleus does what? When it goes through mitosis. Oh, I tell you what, you got to speak up really, really loud. Okay, I heard what happens to the organelles when the cell undergoes mitosis? Yeah? Okay. Well, they just stay there, and then they get separated into the two daughter cells as well. All right, but before mitosis takes place, the cell has got to make multiple copies of these organelles so that when the cell undergoes mitosis, you don't have one cell with an organelle and another cell without it. And the cells undergo duplication under the direction of the nucleus. The nucleus controls that. Okay, so the cell has to get bigger before mitosis takes place. That's in a growth phase, and that's what we call interphase in mitosis. We're going to talk about mitosis maybe in this chapter. Okay, yeah. Yeah, because one cell can't get gypped out of those organelles. They've got to duplicate themselves. We call that replication. Okay, what else are there? Golgi. Nucleus. Yeah, we've been talking about the nucleus the whole time. Secretory vesicles. We talked about that's used for exocytosis of material that's produced by the rough ER as modified by the Golgi apparatus. Lysosomes. Lysosome is an important kind of vesicle. Here is a lysosome. A lysosome looks a lot like this secretory vesicle right here, but again, there is a membrane around this lysosome. What is the basic way, what's the best way to describe the basic structure of a lysosome membrane? It's a phospholipid bilayer, right? That's the simplest description that describes that. How would you describe the membrane around this secretory vesicle? It is a phospholipid bilayer. How could you describe this membrane that surrounds this mitochondria right here? That's a phospholipid bilayer. It's all the same kind of stuff, right? And the membrane around the nucleus is a phospholipid bilayer. But don't forget, there's things that can be dissolved and put inside the membrane, and we would call that the fluid mosaic model that describes how we can add stuff to these membranes. All right, so this lysosome right here is pretty interesting, has some important clinical ramifications too. Inside this vesicle are digestive enzymes. So what happens to something if it gets put inside this lysosome? Yeah, it gets broken down. It gets digested. For instance, if a bacteria tries to infect this cell, if it gets inside the cytoplasm and the cell is smart enough to figure out how this lysosome can surround the bacteria and swallow it up and put it inside the lysosome, guess what happens to the bacterium? Yeah, it dies. It gets digested, right? The lysosome is what I call an intracellular, meaning inside the cell, intracellular digestive system. And those enzymes can be used to digest material that the cell no longer needs, to break it down into various building blocks, or if infectious agents get inside the cell, then the lysosome can digest those infectious agents, maybe even a virus. So this is one way that your cells can fight viruses. Now, your cell needs energy to build and maintain this membrane right here. What's the energy molecule that a cell needs? ATP. That's right. And a cell needs oxygen in order to make ATP. That's why we're breathing. And every once in a while, oxygen might be blocked from getting to a particular cell, like when somebody's heart stops beating. All right? Oxygen is not being transported in the body. And guess what happens to these lysosomes under those conditions? They run out of ATP and they start to break down. So what happens then? What happens to these digestive enzymes? They start running around inside the cell, digesting the cell from the inside. All right, so that's really dangerous. So that actually has important ramifications on how we treat patients that are having a heart attack or some kind of vascular disease where oxygen isn't getting to a tissue. We give them membrane stabilizers like cortisone or something, and that protects the membranes of these lysosomes so these digestive enzymes don't get out into the cell and start digesting the cell that might come back to life if we were to give them oxygen. Yeah.
Is this what happens in sickle cell, and that's why the blood has to be in sync?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know if we'd necessarily treat somebody in sickle cell crisis with cortisone. That might be part of the protocol. I'm just not that familiar. Yeah? Okay. That's probably part of it. Because when somebody's in crisis, oxygen delivery all over their body is being cut back. Sure, that makes perfect sense. You know, their heart, their brain, kidneys, everything. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So if you're going to tell me what the function of a lysosome is, you would want to say digestion, right? Okay. What are some other organelles? We got a few more here to talk about. Mitochondria. What's the function of mitochondria? Makes energy. ATP. Can you see it on the diagram? You know what a mitochondria looks like? It's really easy to identify because it has membranes inside the mitochondria too. And maybe you should know that those are called Christi. I guess I could show you. All right, so these membranes inside the mitochondria are what we call Christi. Now, these mitochondria are pretty interesting because if you were to take a microbiology class, you would say and recognize these mitochondria, they look just like a bacterium, right? And there are, and the mitochondria is a lot different from any other kind of organelle because there are two membranes. Here is the outer membrane of the mitochondria. The Christi are the inner membrane of the mitochondria. And the other interesting thing about a mitochondria is that it has its own genetic material. So a mitochondria has genetic material plus cytoplasm. What do we call something that has genetic material and cytoplasm? A cell. So a mitochondria is partly an organelle because it's living inside our cells, but it is itself a cell. And this is a theory that every scientist now understands, that at some point through evolution, there was a cell that didn't have mitochondria. It looked a lot like a human cell. It had a nucleus and all these organelles. But these cells could not make what very quickly?
ATP.
ATP. And then these cells got infected with this bacterium right here, which specializes in making what? ATP. All right, so the cell said, well, you know what? That's a benefit to me because if this mitochondria here is going to make ATP all day long, then I would be happy to give this bacterium all the oxygen it wants and glucose that it wants as long as it gives me ATP back. What do we call it when two organisms live together side by side and they're beneficial to each other? As a matter of fact, maybe they can't even live apart from each other. They have to live together so that both can live. What do we call that? That's what we call a symbiosis. All right, so all of your cells are really a symbiosis of mitochondria and cells. The cells get ATP from the mitochondria. And what does the mitochondria get from the cell so that everybody can live together? It gets oxygen, and it also is protected from predation. Other things can't eat this mitochondria if it's inside your body, so it's protected. So it's a very nice symbiosis. All right, and the reason why I mention that is because somebody had talked about during mitosis, what happens to organelles? Well, because these mitochondria have their own DNA, it controls its own rate of replication inside the cell. Okay, the cell will reproduce itself and the mitochondria will reproduce itself according to the plans that are included in the DNA inside the mitochondria. So that theory that describes this particular symbiosis is what we call the endosymbiont theory of mitochondria. Endo meaning what? Inside of a cell. Endosymbiont theory. So that's kind of mind-boggling, actually, that you have all these other little jobbers living inside all your cells, which are really kind of independent organisms. But through evolution, our cells can't function without these mitochondria, and mitochondria can't function without living inside of a human cell. So it's really one life form now, but you should go back in evolution to appreciate how that evolved. this is where I wanted to go. Centrioles. We see centrioles right here inside the cell. These have kind of a cylindrical shape to them, like this. And usually they're perpendicular to each other. They're filled with microtubules. And all the microtubules inside the cell attach somehow to the centrioles. So the centrioles organize microtubules, which then what organize how things move around inside the cell or what the shape of the cell has. So the centrioles organize microtubules for movement inside the cell or cell shape. That's the job of the centrioles. Can you see them right here? Okay. It organizes the microtubules inside the cell. Microfilaments and microtubules. And the microfilaments and microtubules move things around inside the cell and give the cell its shape. Because some cells are going to be long and narrow, some are going to be flat, and some are going to be like a cube. And it's the microtubules and the centrioles that pull and push on the membrane to give cells or shape. And as a matter of fact, there's some cells that are shapeshifters. What does that mean? They can change their shape. They can squish around. They can squirt between other cells in your body. And it's the microtubules that allow for that shape-shifting as controlled by these centrioles right here. Okay. Cilia and flagella. There are projections. We can see projections coming off the cell surface, and what is controlling that are microtubules that are pushing out the cytoplasm. And these projections can have a number of different kind of looks to them. On this diagram, I only see one kind. I see a microvilli. That's the smallest kind. Microvilli, I think, was the third item on your list. These are important. These microvilli are important because they allow for exchange from inside the cell to the outside. It increases the surface area of the cell. Microvilli increase the surface area of the cell. And then we have two other structures, which aren't on this diagram, unfortunately, but they're called cilia and flagellum. A cilia, or cilium, is going to look a lot like this microvilli, except it's going to be maybe 7, 8, maybe 10 times longer. So it's going to be a projection off the surface of the cell, and it has microfilaments inside of it as well. And these microfilaments can slide over each other back and forth, and it causes a cilia to bend. All right? So cilia, okay, when it, the surface of a cell might have hundreds of cilia, and they all bend in the same direction, so it's going to sweep fluid over the surface of the cell. So that's important. The term we use for that, for cilia, is motility. All right, so movement is what we mean by motility. All right, a flagellum. There's only one kind of cell, and it's only guys that have them, have cells with flagellum. Okay, and that's a sperm. Yeah, sperm cell has a flagellum. So we said that if this is the length of a microvilli, a cilia would be maybe 10 times longer. A flagellum is even much longer than that. It might be 20 or 30 times longer compared to a cilium. And a flagellum has these microfilaments on the inside that slide past each other that cause the flagellum to whip around. Right? So again, the function of a flagellum is for motility. Right? It allows that sperm to swim around. Okay. So what else do we have? So what is cytoplasm? Yep, it's everything inside the cell membrane or plasma membrane, everything inside, which is cytosol and organelles. Okay. Here's another concept that you could use, nucleoplasm. What the heck is nucleoplasm? If cytoplasm is everything inside the cell membrane, nucleoplasm is everything inside the nuclear membrane or nuclear envelope. Nuclear envelope and nuclear membrane are really the same kind of thing. Okay, so let's see. I guess we got to stop, huh? Mm-hmm. It's about that time. So when we come back, remind me to start here with nuclear structures. Okay, have a nice vacation. But work your study plan, your weekly study plan, because you might have to study a little bit on Monday. As a matter of fact, you should probably study a lot on Monday.